Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. I am also in Edinburgh because, after all,
where else would I be? Yes, we are, again, locked down in our separate flats, a quarter of a mile from one another, or something. All right.
Although there are hints that the lockdown might be relaxed eventually.
Eventually in the future. Yeah. All right, which is not our area of expertise. Two interesting stories in the news this week that I think we're going to sort of build this episode around. One was a Supreme Court case that was heard via telephone on Monday that involves a man in Oklahoma of Native American ancestry who is challenging his conviction in an Oklahoma court, claiming that he should be tried under a tribal court. And a situation developing in South Dakota, which is still unfolding, in which two Native American reservations have set up checkpoints to control for the coronavirus, and they are being challenged by the South Dakota governor, claiming that they are interfering with transportation and commerce across the state, and she's threatened to take them to court to shut down those checkpoints. What both these cases have in common is that they are, in some ways, about tribal sovereignty, Native American sovereignty, and the sort of complex relationships that Native American tribes and nations have with the federal government, with the state government, with the people. And so we thought we'd sort of start to unpack some of that today and try to provide some historical context. And in some ways, I guess this is a continuation of our conversation last week where we were talking about federalism. We were talking about the relationship between the state governments and the federal government. You throw tribal government in there and it creates even more sort of nuance and complexity into the whole story. So we want to sort of unpack how small that works.
That's right, David, because a big part of this from a constitutional and legal standpoint isn't just about the relationship between the United States and Native peoples and indigenous nations, but also about who has authority to negotiate with those nations, the federal government or the states. And so to some extent, it's another area where the states and the federal government have come into conflict.
To be sure, right.
Yeah.
So before, I think we're going to talk about both of those cases, in some detail. But before, yeah, let's see if we can provide some sort of backstory to all of this. When you go back and look at the colonial era, before we sort of get to the Constitution of the United States, Frank, how did European powers deal with indigenous people on a sort of legal constitutional basis?
Well, I'd hesitate to talk about European powers. I think we should talk about one particular European power, which is Britain.
Okay.
In the sense that because that's the relationship that sets the precedent that will be followed or not or broken with by the by the United States government. It's not that what the French, Dutch, Spanish, et cetera, were doing isn't important, but it's less relevant for our conversation, I think.
Sure.
So in terms of Britain, and the British Empire prior to independence, we see dilemmas that are quite similar to some of the debates we see today between, or the contests we see today between the states and the federal government when it comes to dealing with Native Americans. So what we saw during the colonial period, for example, was individual colonies might pursue their own policies towards Indians, and those policies almost inevitably were about displacing Indians from land and obtaining native lands, although they also related to things like sending missionaries to native peoples or educating Indians and things like that. But mainly it's about acquiring land. And the British government, the imperial government from London, also sought to negotiate with and treat with indigenous peoples too, and it claimed, like the federal government does today in the United States, that ultimately it was superior and its authority should take primacy over that of the individual colonies, which in this analogy are similar to the states today. And so we had competing policies, which could often be quite confusing for people on both sides of the racial divide, but particularly confusing for indigenous people who might be confronted with, I don't know, settlers and representatives from, say, Virginia in the Ohio country at the same time that they were also negotiating with British-appointed Indian agents, as they were called, who were representing the empire. And these different groups of people might be saying different things, contradictory things, seeking to undermine each other. One of the causes of the American Revolution, or one of the early causes of the American Revolution, was the 1763 proclamation line, so created by George III by royal proclamation, hence the name, separating, notionally drawing a line more or less down the where the Appalachian Mountains are today, and saying Native peoples, Indians should live to the west of that line, and whites should live to the east. This was meant to stop fighting that broke out right after the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763. It was seen as a kind of temporary measure, but it illustrates the kind of tensions and confusions that we're talking about. Colonists, this became one of the grievances for the colonists, who felt that their right to settle in the West was being interfered with by the government in London. So there's a long backstory here when it comes to competing centers of power negotiating with Native peoples. Then when go ahead.
Yeah, well, the 63 Proclamation line, I think, it sort of foretells a you know, much of the story that we're going to see. Not only is there competing interests there between the colonial governments, you know, many of whom had these sort of claims that went all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and the imperial powers in London, but you also had individual white settlers who decided to squat on Native lands.
That's right.
You know, west of the line, and who is responsible for policing that? What redress do Native Americans have when those agreements are violated? You know, and London didn't have the power, or at least didn't act upon their authority, their claimed authority, to regulate that line. And so you do have sort of widespread encroachment. And so it's a, you know, the sort of idea of sovereignty being split and shared in various ways, you know, it sort of adds complexity to this whole story from the very beginning.
That's right. And in so-called Indian country, it's more complicated still, because you're dealing with imbalances of power. You're dealing, you know, race is part of this. There are so many kind of it's a complicated question anyway, dividing sovereignty and who's got authority, and the kind of questions we see in these Supreme Court cases, who can prosecute crimes, etc., all those things. And then you overlay all of that with the kind of cultural assumptions that each side is bringing to it, and imperialism, frankly, and it makes for a very, very complicated situation, which, as we see today.
All right, so I'm going to get to the Constitution. What does the Constitution say about all this?
Yeah, the Constitution doesn't say a lot about this. Native Americans are mentioned several times in the Constitution. In Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, which we know most notoriously as the Three-Fifths Clause, which as it pertained to enslaved people. But that article and section also says representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, and then the Three-Fifths Clause, excluding Indians not taxed. So according to that clause, Native Americans were essentially excluded from the constitutional settlement drafted in 1787, adopted in 1789 or 88, and coming into effect in 1789. Essentially, Native Americans were denied citizenship. They were also not to be taxed. So if there's a benefit there, it's that. Article 1, Section 8 says Congress shall have the right to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Now, that's a very interesting section to me, because it's drawing a distinction between foreign nations, the individual states that comprise the United States, and Indian tribes or Native American nations. It's so they're not treating Native American nations, the Constitution doesn't treat them as the equivalent of foreign nations, but nor are they just like states in the United States. So it's creating three different categories three different types of polity, if you will, that Congress crucially has authority to negotiate with. And so Article 1, Section 8 has these three different categories, but crucially for our subsequent discussion, it also says that Congress has the authority to negotiate with Native American tribes, not any other element of the government. And one of the things we see in subsequent cases, as we'll get to in a minute, is that the federal government asserts that it, not the states, has the right to negotiate with Native American tribes, but that power rests particularly with Congress within the federal government. Sorry, yeah. David.
Well, I was just thinking about the ways in which, you know, thinking about the important treaties the United States gets involved in both after the Revolution and then, you know, subsequent to the Constitution. You know, when they have a number of treaties with Native Americans and they have a number of treaties with European powers, but those tend to be very different sets of negotiations, right? So if we think about sort of the treaties that end the American Revolution, the treaties that end the War of 1812, those are treaties the United States signs with Britain and with European powers in a particular context. And the treaties that they sign with Native Americans at about the same time are often separate, despite the fact that those are clearly related phenomena. One could imagine a very alternate history of the American Revolution, in which there are Native peoples involved in the treaties to end the American Revolution, but they're not, right? And so there's always a ways in which they're seen as you point out in this Article 1, Section 8 part, where they are seen as being separate from the states, but also separate from foreign nations. They are something else.
That's right.
That sort of intermediate stage, I think, sort of speaks to the tension we're going to see really throughout the next two centuries, where Indian nations are seen as both distinct and separate sovereign powers from the federal government and the state government, but also not completely separate and sovereign the way that foreign nations are.
Right. I mean, I think that's a really good point, David. To take just two examples briefly that are roughly coterminous, we have the 1794 Jay Treaty between Britain and the United States, which actually has implications for Native Americans, and I'll say more about that in a second. And then we have the 1795 Treaty of Greenville between the United States government and Native peoples in mainly what's today Ohio. And in the Jay Treaty, that's basically a commercial treaty between the United States and Britain. It's meant to resolve some of the outstanding differences in British-American relations, kind of hanging over from the Revolution. Under its terms, the British agree to cede forts that they occupy in the Old Northwest, modern Ohio and Indiana and Michigan, that they were using to trade with Native Americans and to encourage Native Americans in that region to resist the United States. That's all been resolved. Having resolved that, the United States then turned around and in the Treaty of Greenville forced the Shawnees and other Native peoples in Ohio to cede tens of thousands of acres of land to the United States. So what you're seeing is, as you just said, we see the United States dealing with Native peoples in one way and Europeans or recognized Western powers, if you will, in another. To some extent, this is about power. When the United States negotiates with Britain in 1794, it's the weaker of the two parties. When it's negotiating with Native peoples in Ohio in 1794 and 95, there's a long backstory there we don't need to get into, but having recently defeated them militarily after sustained Indian resistance, they're dealing from a position of relative strength. So one thing I would say about this diplomacy, and I want to give a shout out to a book that I'm really, really looking forward to. Elijah Gould from the University of New Hampshire is writing a new history of the Peace of Paris of 1783. And Elijah's book is making an argument that's really, really interesting. And he's arguing, and this has implications for Native peoples, he's arguing in this book that the Peace of 1783 needs to be seen as one of the first great imperial partitions, not unlike the partition of India and Pakistan that happened after the Second World War with decolonization in South Asia. Lige is arguing that what we see in the Peace of Paris is a partition of North America that will have implications for indigenous peoples. It's going to be a really, really interesting and provocative book. It's going to be an important book. I'll just say that by way of...
Oh, well, if we're plugging books that haven't been finished yet, I also want to plug Lawrence Hatter's work, who's working on the Jay Treaty and the sort of long afterlife of the Jay Treaty. And he's found a number of cases in recent decades where Native Americans are using the Jay Treaty to say, actually, look, the Jay Treaty guarantees me the right to cross the U.S.-Canadian border as one of the tenets of that treaty. And so they're sort of they're in an anomalous situation where everyone else has to stop on the border and has to have particular rights for working across international boundaries.
That's right. And Larry and Lodge, look forward to those two books. But Lawrence's is really important. I think you're right, because what we see with the Jay Treaty is Native peoples are being subject – they're a subject of negotiations between the United States and Britain, but they are not party to those negotiations, which is one of the problems about the early diplomacy involving Native Americans, because often Native voices were not at the table.
Right. Thinking about sort of Native voices – being at the table or not. I mean, I think one of the stories of, the 19th century, obviously, is about the displacement of Native peoples, both east and west of the Mississippi, and sort of the role of the federal government in both being sort of the agent that's doing that displacement, but also an agent that's at various points in time trying to sort of regulate and control relationships between white settlers, state governments, and Native peoples, and we see this a lot during the Marshall Court, right? I think the Marshall Court is trying very hard to figure out exactly where these boundaries lie and exactly how Native peoples fit into the sort of federal system as it evolves. And there's a whole series of decisions that the Marshall Court lays down in the 1820s and early 1830s, having to do especially with the relationship between the Cherokee and the state of Georgia, in which the state of Georgia is very much trying to encroach upon Cherokee land, upon which there have been found, among other things, lots of gold, and where exactly those boundaries lie. Frank, it sounded like you had a thought.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, David. I've got a number of thoughts on this. So Marshall, of course, was a Federalist, which meant he believed in federal power. And one of the issues here, which we talked about with respect to the Constitution, is that the Constitution vests the authority to negotiate with Native Americans and to regulate Native Americans, is the phrase in Article 1, or regulate the trade of Native Americans, with Congress. And Marshall was, I think, quite committed to assert federal authority and federal power over the states in this regard. So there are a series of decisions, as you said, and these are in the run-up to the Trail of Tears, of course. But there are three decisions that are really, really important that the Marshall Court issues. In 1823, in Johnson versus McIntosh, Supreme Court rules that private citizens cannot purchase land from Native American tribes. So the federal government is supposed to do that, not individual American citizens. Then we cast our mind forward. There are a pair of decisions in 1831 and 1832, which are usually taken together, and they both involve Georgia, as you said, because Georgia was – and Georgians were very keen to encroach on Cherokee lands then. I mean, again, this is prior to Indian removal a few years later. In 1831, in the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, the court ruled essentially that that Native American tribes were likened them to the relationship was that between a ward to its guardian, and this is where the notion that Native American tribes were domestic dependent nations. So they're nations, but they're not independent kind of foreign countries. They're dependent on the United States. But again, dependent on the United States, not the individual states. And the Marshall Court followed that up with a decision in 1832, Worcester versus Georgia, which said the federal government, has the authority to deal with Native peoples, not the states. So this was consistent with both Marshall's constitutional vision about the superiority and of the federal government vis-a-vis the states, but also the defining the federal government's relationship with Native Americans. We're getting into your period, though, David, so I've been talking a lot, so I'm happy to kind of cede ground to you. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I mean, the famous thing, of course, that happens after Worcester versus Georgia, and it's probably apocryphal, but I think it's sort of telling nonetheless, is after John Marshall had sided with the Cherokee, Andrew Jackson supposedly said, Mr. Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. And I think, part of the story about sort of Native American sovereignty and sort of where rests, I think we have to think both about de jure sovereignty and de facto sovereignty, because the Supreme Court had made this ruling in their favor, but in practice, there's very little that the Supreme Court, in fact, there's nothing the Supreme Court could have done to actually stop the state of Georgia or the white people in Georgia from displacing Native peoples there. And I think that's part of the story, really, throughout the 19th century, in which very often the Native nations signed treaties with the United States government. The United States government either doesn't fulfill the terms of the treaty or doesn't actually engage in the kinds of obligations that they have under the treaty. And then those cause sort of a cycle of response and reaction, which then often causes the federal government to respond with greater violence. One of the, I think, examples of this is what is often called the Dakota War, or the Great Sioux Uprising, goes by different names depending on which sort of historiographical period you're looking at. But this is in the middle of the Civil War. It's in 1862. And it's a conflict that arose from an earlier treaty the United States government had signed with the Dakota people in 1851 that had promised basically two important things. One is they promised they would stop white settlement into Dakota territory, and that they would provide an annuity to Native peoples, both in terms of food and other goods, and in terms of money. And what basically happened in what is now Minnesota, or was then Minnesota too, I guess, is that white settlement can continue to encroach upon the Dakota people, and the federal government stopped paying its annuity, at least to the satisfaction of the Native Americans. And, when they responded, there's a small incident with a small handful of young Dakota men where they end up killing five settlers as part of a hunting expedition, I think, in 1862. That culminates actually in a sort of widespread war across Minnesota and the Dakota territories. And that culminates in a mass execution of 38 Dakota men in December of 1862. But the backstory to that has to do with the relationship between the Native peoples, the federal government, the state government, and what sort of recourse do Native peoples have when the federal government doesn't actually live up to the terms of its treaties. Because I think the long story of the 19th century is oftentimes of Native Americans agreeing to treaties with the federal government and then the federal government not fully enforcing the terms of those treaties. And we see that in Oklahoma, we see that in the Great Plains, we see that in the far west. We really see that almost everywhere where there's tensions between white settlers and Native Americans, that white settlers sort of predominate. And then we have a movement, I think, in the late 19th century in which the federal government decides to take a stance, and they claim they're doing this out of respect for indigenous people, although one can sort of doubt their claims. A policy of Americanizing Native peoples. And the premise, I think, by the end of the 19th century, after these long series of wars on the plains, in which Native Americans don't fare particularly well, it is that the obligation of the federal government is to basically deconstruct tribal structures to make Native Americans into Americans. One of the places you see this is with the Dawes Act, which is a piece of legislation passed in 1887 that intends to replace land held communally as part of a reservation with land held by individual Native Americans. And the idea, I guess, is to convert Native Americans into homesteaders, essentially. In practice, one of the things the Dawes Act did, besides undermining tribal sovereignty, is actually open up a huge amount of land, because all the other land that the tribes held communally ends up getting auctioned off to for white settlement. So it's another way in which sort of the size, the footprint of indigenous sovereignty gets shrunk down tremendously. And of course, this is happening all at the same time that Native American boarding schools are being set up that are designed in large part to acculturate Native children into white cultural patterns and strip them of Native American languages and religions and identities, which also sort of serves to undermine indigenous sovereignty. And I think what you find going on to the 20th century, which is obviously outside both of our areas of expertise, is the federal government both at various points in time trying to recognize Native American sovereignty and trying to minimize the role of Native Americans. For instance, in 1934, you've got the Indian Reorganization Act, which is an effort to sort of reestablish tribal sovereignty. But then during the 1950s, you've got a termination policy put in place by the Eisenhower administration, which tends then to try to sort of restrict Native sovereignty. And so it's a fight that really sort of continues in pretty profound ways really throughout the 20th century over where exactly the boundaries of Native sovereignty rest and where exactly state government has authority to impose itself upon Native peoples. But I think you're one of the things I think the two big stories we're talking about, Frank. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. That was a really good summary, David. Can I just add two slight qualifiers?
Oh,
which
by all
is
means.
by the late 19th century, the United States stops negotiating treaties with Native peoples, and the authority it starts to negotiate via statute or to interact via congressional statute, and that really puts the emphasis, therefore, on the courts as a key instrument for interpreting that relationship. And the other thing is, and the other point I would add is, according to in 1924. Citizenship is formally extended to Native Americans. So the citizenship, American citizenship, that is extended to all Native Americans, which had previously been denied them via the original Constitution. So those are just two key points of detail that we need to think about that's why the courts are going to be so important during the 20th century.
Right. So in 1924, some Native Americans had citizenship as a consequence of treaty and history, and some didn't, and that extends citizenship. It's interesting also at that point is when the income tax comes into place.
Right.
So we think about Indians not taxed in the Constitution. The point in which the citizenship is extended is the same point in which taxation gets extended.
That's right.
It's interesting sort of pairing there. I think one of the things you are seeing, though, and especially in the past 40 years, is a real resurgence in claims about tribal sovereignty. And I think this is in some ways an outgrowth of the Native American rights movement from the 1960s and 1970s. And I think also a greater recognition by the federal government that it's the long history of the federal government's relationship with Native Americans is shameful, to put it mildly, necessitates actually treating tribal sovereignty seriously. Which doesn't necessarily mean that state governments are necessarily happy about that, but I think that seems to be the thrust of things in recent decades.
Right. I mean, I agree with you, David. So, like, you get the 1978 Oliphant decision, in which the court rules that tribal courts don't have jurisdiction. They have jurisdiction over Native peoples, but not over non-Indians. And that's in 1981 in the Montana versus U.S. decision. The court rules the tribes have power over their own internal affairs. So there's a there's an effort made in this series of decisions to demarcate just what the authority of just what native sovereignty means. But I think you in your comment, the crew said something that's really important, which is the tension, therefore, is between the states and the tribes, and the United States and the federal court system end up trying to adjudicate disputes. Often what they're doing is adjudicating disputes between the states and the tribes. And that's the common theme that runs through a lot of the disputes of the past 40 years, including the two cases that you began the show with today. The case in Oklahoma, the criminal case in Oklahoma, and the question over the roadblocks in South Dakota. So both of those are about not the federal government's relationship with Native peoples, but the states of South Dakota and Oklahoma, respectively, and their conflicts with Native peoples and coming in and challenging Native sovereignty.
Right. Well, I mean, though, there is one case recently that I think is really interesting to think about the role of the federal government in, just from a few years ago, and I think it's gotten buried in a bit because of all the other things that have been going on in the past 4 years. But that's the 2016 Dakota Access Pipeline protests.
Yeah, can you say something about that?
Right. So I can say a little bit at least. So Western North Dakota is a home, I think, as well as some people might know too, an enormous oil field, the Bakken shale oil fields. There was an effort there. They were building a pipeline to connect this oil field to sort of the mainstream oil pipelines. So it's going to run from, the plan was to run from North Dakota to Illinois, and then it goes south to Louisiana. And the original plan for the pipeline had it pass through a fairly densely populated, for North Dakota, white community. And after the white community protested, let's say we don't want the pipeline passing this close to us, he got rerouted through not actually through a reservation, but adjacent to a reservation, including some land that was owned by Native peoples near the Standing Rock Reservation. And this led to widespread protests where indigenous activists and their allies said, look, this is a pipeline that is the likelihood of a spill in this pipeline is very high. The likelihood of it contaminating the water table is very high. Native Americans have not been properly consulted about sort of access to their land and the ways in which this is going to be detrimental to not only land that they live on, but land that is considered sacred by Dakota people. And this led to, fairly, at least out in the middle of nowhere, well-attended protests that lasted for several months and led to some pretty heavy-handed response by the part of the pipeline. Police and riot gear showed up. They had things that looked like tanks to me. I was told they're not actually tanks, but they looked like tanks, to try to displace the protesters. And the Obama administration at one point sort of stepped in. This is obviously the very end of the Obama administration, stepped in to try to sort of negotiate the settlement and try to have a further environmental impact assessment by the Army Corps of Engineers. But then when President Trump took office, he signed an executive order basically stopping all of that and ordering them to go ahead and build the pipeline. But I think that sort of speaks to this sort of this long history of the federal government sort of largely dismissing the claims of Native peoples, especially when there's sort of bigger economic interests involved, like this pipeline. It turns out there actually have been some spills in the Dakota pipeline now that it's been built, and it's been, I think, overshadowed by all the other news. But I think that actually sort of speaks to some of the issues with these two cases that arose this week. Should we talk about the case in South Dakota? Because I think this is sort of connects pretty well with some of the things we've been talking about. Sure. What's been happening in South Dakota is South Dakota's got a Republican governor, Kristi Noem, who is sort of on the Trump wing of the Republican Party. I think that's probably a fair assessment. And she has resisted basically shutting down South Dakota in response to the coronavirus. So businesses have largely remained open there. There haven't been the kinds of shutdowns that have taken place in most of the rest of the country. And two Native American groups have established checkpoints. The Cheyenne River Sioux and the Oglala River Sioux have established checkpoints to monitor people coming in and out of reservation land. And this includes checkpoints that are on some state highways. You know, and she has said that this is illegal, that these checkpoints, and the Native Americans have said no, in fact, that they're not, that under the treaty obligations of the federal government, they have the right to regulate who comes in and out of tribal land. And interestingly enough, some Republican state legislators have actually sided with the Native position on this. So it's an interesting moment in which you're having these fights between state government and over what seems to be an internal question within a state. Usually you would think of state governments having kind of sovereignty over questions about traveling within the state itself, but this is a case where there's sort of conflicting notions of sovereignty.
Right, but I think it's an interesting case because the checkpoints are on tribal land, although the roads themselves are state highways, and so that's where we get this conflict. Because, as we said earlier, the case law seems quite clear that the states don't have individual states. In this case, South Dakota do not have sovereignty on tribal lands. I would say one other thing that I find interesting about this case is Governor Noem, despite her Trumpist predilections, has expressed a willingness to negotiate on this question. So they haven't been, while there is a conflict, she hasn't been that heavy-handed, especially when you see what happened at Standing Rock in neighboring North Dakota, just in the recent past. She hasn't responded in that way yet, and so she sent letters to both tribal groups to open negotiations and suggested that maybe tribal roads could have checkpoints, but the state highway for people who are passing through might not, or whatever. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, you're absolutely right. It underscores all the issues we've been talking about today and the issues that run, you know, like a thread through the complex relations between Native Americans and United States, the governments of the United States and the individual states. But it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out, I think.
And there's a couple of contextual issues here that are really important. One is, you know, these are the reservations in South Dakota are extraordinarily remote and poor, right? The unemployment rate, even under the best of times, was very high. The health conditions among people who live on the reservations are not great and haven't been for many, many decades. So there's problems with alcoholism, there's problems with other sort of poor health outcomes that are very deep-seated. And so these are very vulnerable populations in some ways. The medical facilities locally are not very robust. So if there was an outbreak, they don't have the facility to care for. They don't have the respirators and all those other kinds of things. And the nearest place that does is several hundred miles away. So the consequences were the coronavirus to have a significant outbreak on these reservations is pretty severe. And thus far, they have not had a severe outbreak. And the other thing to consider is that on other Native American reservations, there have been outbreaks of coronavirus that have been just devastating. And one of the worst impacted places in the United States right now is among the Navajo.
That's right.
Where, have a similar, they're similarly in a very remote part of the country without great access to health care. There's a significant portion of Navajo, for instance, who don't have running water, and nevertheless good access to, respirators. And I think the Sioux in South Dakota are looking at what's happened to the Navajo and are saying, look, if that happens here, we're going to have, it's going to be really horrific. And obviously the impact of diseases upon Native peoples throughout American history has been enormously devastating. And I think, you know, this has sort of echoes of that. And so I think that's, you know, factoring into to the you know, choices that have been made by both the Cheyenne and Oglala communities.
Yes.
All right. Let's look at the Oklahoma case, because I think there's a sort of a slightly different set of issues there. This is actually, I guess, the second case involving Native Americans in Oklahoma the Supreme Court has dealt with in recent years. There was a case 2 years ago that involved basically the same constitutional issues, but that ended in a 4-4 tie because one of the justices recused himself. The sort of background to the McGirt case versus Oklahoma is a really horrific story of a man sexually abusing a very small child. And I don't think there's any dispute in the case about the man's guilt. But it's about questions over sovereignty and questions over jurisdiction. How does this, Frank, connect to the things we've been talking about?
Well, it relates because the Mr. McGirt, the man who was convicted, is a Native American, and he was convicted in state court in Oklahoma and sentenced to, I think, life in prison plus 2 500-year sentences. So he's not going anywhere if that sentencing holds up. He is claiming that he should not have been convicted by the state of Oklahoma because, as an indigenous man, he should have been tried by a tribal court because the crime occurred on tribal land.
And the victim was also.
Thank you. Yeah. So he basically his claim is that the state of Oklahoma has no jurisdiction over him, and the issue seems to be this is as you say, David, the facts of the case are absolutely horrible, but the issues are similar to the ones that have been running through the whole question of U.S. Native relations, really from going back to the writing of the Constitution, which is who's got authority. And the state of Oklahoma is claiming that it convicted him, that the place where the crime was committed actually has a white majority or a non-native, I should say, majority population, and that Oklahoma law and jurisdiction applies there. And the Muscogee Creek Nation is claiming, you know, that it has jurisdiction, and McGirt is claiming that he should be subject to tribal law. It's quite leaving aside the horrific details of the case, the issues are quite consistent with what we've seen before. And case law, I am not a lawyer.
And neither of us are lawyers, and this is a very particular area of law that is, I think, outside the training of most lawyers.
Yes, so. As we've demonstrated in this podcast, probably beyond our expertise. However, my reading of the case law is such that it seems to be, I think that the case law suggests that he's got a case. The plaintiff has a case in the sense that he should have been subject to tribal law, not Oklahoma law. It's always hard when the plaintiff is a thoroughly reprehensible person who's done awful things. But that's, of course, not the issue here. The court is meant to interpret the constitutional issue here about who's got authority, and this question of sovereignty is at the heart of it.
Yeah. Well, the case from 2 years ago that ended in a 4-4 tie was an equally horrible case of murder. I don't know, equally. Commensurately awful case.
Yeah.
But I think one of the issues I think that's sort of running through some of the discussion about both of these cases and sort of about the Native Americans' sovereign claims to authority over reservation land and other land is there is some discourse that at least you heard this at least a bit among the Supreme Court justices where they said, yeah, there were these treaties, but they kind of don't matter anymore, right? That it was a long time ago and therefore it's not really relevant. Because in practice, Native Americans haven't exercised sovereignty over this land in a real way for generations. I think there's both a legal response to that and a historical response to that. how should we as historians sort of deal with people's sort of notions that well, okay, maybe they have a treaty claim to something, but those treaty claims are ancient history.
Well, as historians, we actually think history is important. And given the particularly, frankly, terrible history of the relationship between the United States and its constituent states and native peoples, we need to tread very carefully when it comes to violating treaties that the United States entered into. We still honor, for example, the Treaty of 1783 ending the War of Independence and think that applies and is relevant. So I'm not sure why subsequent treaties between the United States and Native peoples also shouldn't still have the force of law. Yeah. So I don't have a lot of sympathy with that.
I guess the follow-up to that then, though, would be if we actually did uphold all the treaties as they are written, does that mean we need to return half of the property in the United States to native jurisdiction?
Well, it's actually not that simple because I'm not being facetious. I mean, a lot of the subsequent case law suggests, and a lot of the treaties actually stipulate that land that there's a real interesting constant or legal question, again, which I'm really not qualified to discuss in any kind of detail, about who actually owns the land, even land that is recognized as native land by the United States government. To some extent, the United States government still claims that land, although it denies the right of states to have the land or to sell the land. That's not as easy a question as your framing would suggest.
Well, no, I know it's not. That's part of
the reason. Yeah, I know you're right. Sorry. I mean, sorry.
Yeah.
That's how podcasts work. We set each other up with questions.
Exactly.
There is a lot of – I mean, you could argue, of course, sure, in answer to your question. But that's a little too facile an answer to a complicated question. Yeah, I don't think the fact that these treaties are old necessarily is the fact. And look, law, I mean, this is established in English, British common law, but particularly English common law, right? No, actually English, not British common law, because Scots law is different. But English common law is based on precedent, and that the importance of precedent has been is an important theme in U.S. law as a consequence of that inheritance. And precedent does two things. Things that were decided a long time ago are important, but also subsequent precedents can change practice as well. So this is where that's why we have courts to interpret all this stuff.
Well, yeah, there was an interesting case a few years ago in which, as a consequence of these treaties, some Sioux in South Dakota said basically, we want the Black Hills back. Because the treaty says those lands are supposed to belong to us in perpetuity. And the courts have meandered its way through the courts. And the federal government said, oh, well, we'll pay you for them. And they actually came up with a figure that was over $1 billion. And the tribal government said, no, we don't want the $1 billion. We want the land back. And so now the $1 billion is sort of sitting in a federal trust because... On one hand, the courts ruled that the Native Americans are owed this money for the land that they were never paid for. And the Native Americans are refusing to accept the money and say they want the land back, which I think sort of sets an interesting sort of framing over treaty obligations and the extent to which the federal government is upholding them or not.
I mean, it is an interesting question because this is not just an American question. I mean,
to be sure.
So settler colonialism and the legacies of settler colonialism and the legal legacies of them, particularly with regard to land, are important questions in the United States, in Canada, throughout Latin America.
In Australia.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. And so this is it's interesting how different nations and different legal systems deal and political systems deal with this question.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, so we'll see how both of these cases unfold. The Supreme Court case, it looks like we'll have a decision in June, although I guess the timeline for everything in the Supreme Court right now is a bit up in the air, given all of the things. And the situation in South Dakota seems like it's still unfolding, so we will see how that develops.
It should be said before we get to the last drop statement. One of the interesting things is the Supreme Court, which of course is an institution hidebound by tradition, and you know it's all about tradition, has been hearing cases, of course, online and via. Well, I don't know whether they're using Zoom or not. They're certainly using video technology.
They're using telephones, I think, because we can listen in.
That's very modern and hip for them.
Yes, exactly.
And it's interesting because Clarence Thomas, who normally doesn't say anything, is like he's Chatty Cathy when it comes to being on the phone. So he's so there you go.
So he's been doing this for the past 30 years. We could have heard a lot more of Clarence Thomas.
That's right. Well, anyway, yes, my last drop, David. I want to acknowledge the passing of a former I was going to say a colleague of ours. He was our predecessor, George Sam Shepperson. He was known as Sam. Sam Shepperson came to the University of Edinburgh in 1948, soon after his service in the Second World War. He had fought in Burma with the King's African Rifles, where he developed an interest in – that's important because he developed an interest in African history during his wartime service and was a pioneer in the – teaching of African history at the University of Edinburgh, but also American history. So when he arrived, I think he taught on a course called Imperial and American History. And when I arrived, the library was organized. There was a section of Imperial and Commonwealth history where the American history books were kept. So these legacies persisted for some time. And Sam Shepperson taught both African history and American history at the University of Edinburgh. He brought Paul Robeson, the great American singer and civil rights activist, to Edinburgh in 1949.
Wow.
And arranged a Robeson to give a concert at a local miners' club in Midlothian in 1949, which must have been quite an event. And Sam Shepperson was a real pioneer in the study of the United States at the university. In 1963, he was appointed as the William Robertson Professor of, I believe, then Imperial and Commonwealth History. And he was helped establish the big survey course in American history that some of our listeners might have taken, American History 2. He retired in 1986. I only met him once. I arrived in 1997. But he died recently. He died in early April I don't know what he died from, so I shouldn't say anything. But he was 98 years old. He had a good innings, as they say here. And he was a really important figure in the history of the university. He helped establish the Centers for African Studies and Canadian Studies at the university. And so I want to acknowledge one of our predecessors and also one of our colleagues. So Diana Payton, who's a historian of Jamaica, currently holds the William Robertson Chair, which Sam vacated in 1986. So I want to acknowledge and kind of raise a virtual glass to Sam Shepperson.
Oh.
What about wonderful. You, Dave?
Well, I want to endorse two things, one of which actually only occurred to me as we were having our discussion, and the one that occurred to me just 15 minutes ago, were the novels of Tony Hillerman.
Yep.
Have you read those?
I have. Go.
Yeah, I know you're a big fan of detective novels. Well, Tony Hillerman wrote he's passed away now, but he wrote dozens of detective novels that are set in New Mexico, that are based on Native American, on Navajo tribal police, and so many of the questions that they're beautifully written novels. They sort of evoke the place in a really profound way, but they also reflect these interesting questions about jurisdiction over tribal police, the FBI, the state police, and where those sit. And for people who are looking for a sort of fun way to sort of get some of these issues, obviously in a fictional context, but based on real situations, Tony Hillerman novels are great fun. The other thing I want to endorse is a local thing. My wife and I have recently started venturing out on our daily constitutional walks that we're allowed to do. And we've been trying to sort of explore bits and pieces of Edinburgh that we, for one reason or other, haven't seen. And a couple of days ago, we ventured, actually not far from where both Frank and I live, to a place called Wild West Morningside. Morningside is a neighborhood not far from both Frank and I. It's a very nice neighborhood. But if you sort of duck around the corner behind the Morningside Library, there is a small section of street that looks like it's a recreation from a Wild West movie, complete with a jail and a saloon and a blacksmith shop. And obviously it's just store frontage. It looks like it's the story behind it is part of a promotion from a furniture company from the 1980s, but is still there. So you can visit the Wild West, at least temporarily, on your daily constitutional walks if you are a local here in Edinburgh.
So where is it exactly, David?
So if you're walking off of Morningside Road, do you know where the Merlin Pub is and the Morningside Library?
Yes.
Sage, so walk
libraries
right past.
Libraries and pubs, I know.
Exactly. These are the landmarks that we understand. If you walk sort of right past the Morningside Library, you take a right on whatever street that is, and then there's sort of a little alleyway just right past that. You enter into this Wild West facade. It's quite weird, but good fun and something to do if you're out in the walk trying to keep from gaining too much weight during the lockdown, which is what I was doing.
Excellent.
Totally unexpected, but it's there. So in a city with castles and palaces and all these other kinds of Scottish things, there's a little bit of America, even a fake America, embedded here. Great.
Excellent. All right.
Next week,
cheers,
Frank.
David.
Cheers.
Yep. Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.